Thanks, Ryan. I'm going to go ahead and start calling the roll. I apologize in advance if I mispronounce anyone's name. Please correct me and let me know so I do not make that mistake in the future. Ashley Miller.
Present.
Rachel Nace.
Present.
Lauren Wade.
Present.
Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Present.
Ida Jimenez. Ida. Alan Lazo.
Present.
Barbara Geyer.
Present.
Becky Strauss, I know had a conflict and could not make it. Yung Ho.
Present.
Ellen Toland. Ellen. Holly Stevens. Holly. Jamila J. Rutherford Tai.
Here.
Hi, Jamila. Mara Romero. Mara. Hey, Marisa Espinosa.
Present.
Great. Hi, Marisa. Vera Warren.
Present.
Excellent. And then we have a new jurisdictional member representing Multnomah County, and that is Fanny Adams.
Present. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Fanny. How you doing?
Good, good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that wraps it up for roll call. Fanny, I don't know if you want to take a minute to just introduce yourself as a new member.
Sure. So today is my seventh day in this new position of the Community Development Block Grant Coordinator. I will be leading the work for the Fairview, Troutdale, Wood Village, Maywood Park, and surrounding areas. And I look forward to learning what you guys have been doing and learning more about FHAC.
Excellent. Thank you. And with that, we will move into updates. The first big update, of course, is that we now have a chair and a vice chair for FHAC. So it's very exciting news. And we will go ahead and start with our chair appointment. And that is going to be Marisa Espinosa. If you want to take a minute just to introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Hey, everybody. I think you already know me, but Marisa Espinosa, she, her pronouns. I'm with Northwest Pilot Project. We serve older adults in Multnomah County, age 55 and up, who are experiencing housing instability and homelessness. Definitely looking forward to helping with this committee reach our goals, especially just due to the fact that we, as I say so much, see a constant rise in older adult homelessness and so many of the intersections when it comes to protected classes and housing access. So great to be here with you all. Please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you, Marisa. And then our vice chair is going to be Jamila J. Rutherford Tai, if you want to take a moment to introduce yourself to everyone.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jamila. I go by Jay. That's why I have like 19 names in my roll call. I have a company called Responsible Media Group. I do diversity, equity, inclusion work in government and nonprofits mostly. But now I'm switching over to the private sector and working primarily addressing inequities in media. And I wanted to be part of this position because I've been doing this work for so long and it's so frustrating. I'm just here to help move it along because we can get, I know the places that we get stuck all the time and I want to ask the hard questions. So I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. And I'm picking up my kids. So I'm going to go off camera and mute.
Thanks, Jay. And then our other updates this afternoon is first, just letting you y'all know that we did an internal review of the fair ordinances and SB 291 to make sure that they are in alignment. We didn't see any flags raised into how those were interacting. And now we are waiting from a review by the city attorney. So we will let y'all know when we get that back. And then the other update is actually in regards to the agenda for today's meeting. We are actually going to modify the agenda. We are not going to have this last portion where we do an update on the assessment of fair housing. We are still working on developing the work plan. We're in conversations with BPS and BDS about how they are going to interface with the assessment. We're going to have a bunch of exciting stuff to talk about at our January meeting. So we're just not going to do like a full deeper update on that. Matthew Schaubeld will be on hand at 4:30 if anyone has any questions, but you know, we don't really have a larger update to share. And that will conclude our updates unless anyone has any questions or comments on that.
I do. About that assessment, this is Jay. About the assessment, what's the next step into like action to addressing the recommendations? Is that just getting people together? And I just want to know what's the next step.
Are you talking about the recommendations from the 2011 assessment of fair housing?
Yeah, the one you sent just the other day, we got to the agenda and then this assessment that we just got, and it just talked about the findings of, basically like BIPOC and immigrants. And what's the next step with that? Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, no. That's the audit testing report. Alan Lazo from Fair Housing Council is about to do a deep dive presentation on that. And then we're going to discuss the recommendations. So that's okay. Next on this agenda. What I was talking about was the assessment of fair housing, which is sort of like the assessment of like where we are as a city, as far as, you know, fair housing enforcement, fair housing practices. And that is going to be a project that we undertake with FAC over the next year and change. But we don't quite know all the answers to that yet, which is what the update more or less is that we'll have more to share about that in January.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and with that, I think we can move the agenda along to the 2020 audit testing report. And I think, Alan, you are a co-presenter and should be able to share your screen and start walking us through the report.
Great, thank you so much, Brianne. And I, good afternoon, everyone. As you have heard, I'm Alan Lazo. I'm the executive director at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. My pronouns are he, him, his. And I'm joined here today with my colleagues, and if they can, they'll have some roles in the presentation, but I just wanted to give them a chance to introduce themselves. I'm here with Anirban Paul and LaDonna Johnson, and then also KT Furstenberger are here. So do you want to just take a second to say hi, team members?
Hi, everyone. My name is Anirban Paul. I am one of the test coordinators who was involved in this audit test and the report. So yeah, nice to see you all. I'll pass it to my colleague, LaDonna.
Hi, everyone. I'm LaDonna Johnson. I use she, her pronouns. And I am also a testing coordinator here at FHCO and was involved in the audit test and kind of helping put the report together. So happy to be here and thank you. I will pass to KT, I think.
Thanks, Donna. Hi, everyone. I'm KT Furstenberger. I use they or she pronouns. I'm an enforcement coordinator at FHCO. I'm relatively new, so I didn't have a whole lot of involvement in this, except for sort of getting up to speed and learning how I can support the work moving forward. Happy to be here and meet everybody. And I'll pass back to you, Alan.
All right, thank you all. I shared my screen with you all to go through the PowerPoint presentation. Does that look okay for everybody?
Looks great, Alan.
Great, thank you. All right, so we are going to share with you today the results of the audit testing report that we conducted for fiscal year 2020 through 21, which started July 1st and ended June 30th of 2021. So first, I know folks have had a little introduction to the work that we do at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, but let me talk a little bit about that. So as you folks know, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, we are a private, nonprofit, civil rights organization whose work is to promote justice, equity, and inclusion in housing throughout the state of Oregon. So we're a statewide organization. We have staff in Central, Eastern, Southern Oregon, and then also do a fair amount of work here in the Portland and Multnomah County areas. Our work at the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, we are what we refer to as a full service fair housing organization. So we have a team of folks that do education and outreach throughout the state. We do trainings and outreach to different groups, including residents, social service providers, advocates, jurisdictions, as well as housing providers too. We also have a team of enforcement folks. So most of the folks that are here with us today all the folks that are here with us today are part of our enforcement team. So in addition to the testing work that we're going to talk about today, we also run a housing discrimination hotline that folks who are experiencing discrimination can call and seek assistance from us. We can help further investigate what's going on and then help advocate for them in their cases. We also do work around public policy advocacy. So some of the work that we show up in this space to do is also a part of our public policy work to help move forward and encourage public policy that supports fair housing and equal access to housing throughout the state. We also do that quite predominantly at the state level. So that's a little bit about the organization. The work that we do is rooted squarely in and solely on the Fair Housing Act. So we are the only organization in the state of Oregon whose work is focused solely on fair housing. So we work to enforce and support local, state, and federal fair housing laws. And there can be different pieces at each of those levels. The Fair Housing Act at the federal level was passed in 1968, and it is built predominantly on the work of folks like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the open housing movement, and really focused on, especially at that time in the mid 20th century, to end residential segregation, and particularly Black and white residential segregation during that time. In the initial Fair Housing Act, there were four protected classes: race, color, national origin, and religion were protected classes. The act was amended to include gender in the 1970s, and then in 1988, there was a pretty major update to the Fair Housing Act that included protected classes for disability and for, I'm going to forget what else got added. Sounds protect class. I know I shouldn't do it without a list. Familial status. How could I forget? So familial status. So what you might notice in that list that is not on the federal level is source of income. And we're going to talk about source of income today. And it's been part of our conversations here in this committee. Although the HUD now recognizes the intersections that we know exist around source of income, which means in a lot of cases, folks who might be using things like housing choice vouchers, they do recognize the intersections, the disparate impact that housing choice voucher and source of income have with some federal protected classes, including race, color, national origin, disability, and familial status. So there is some movement around source of income at the federal level and the ability to do that work at that level. But it is a state protected class that was passed in 2014. And so we're going to talk more about source of income as a protection in the state of Oregon as we go through the work that's done here today. The work that we did here and the work that we all do together in FHAC is also rooted in this analysis of impediments or assessment of fair housing and the work to evaluate data that can help direct the policies and recommendations that we might want to see in the analysis or the assessment of fair housing that can help remove barriers to equal housing opportunity in the city. I think in this case, actually, all of the tests were what we call audit tests. And so There's a difference between the two different type of tests that we conduct. Let me flip over this. And I'll talk a little bit about that next, but also talk, as you all know, that the analysis of impediments or assessment of fair housing, again, is that opportunity for us to analyze, identify those impediments or barriers to housing choice in the city, and then work to create strategies and actions to remove those barriers, working with our different sets of partners. So again, let me go back to talk about the difference between audit testing and complaint-based testing. And that's an important distinction here when we talk about the role of testing and this data in the work that we do in what I'll now refer to as the AI or the AFH, the analysis of impediments or the assessment of fair housing. Audit testing is a more randomized, but not totally random, selection of testing targets that help us give an idea about what's happening in the rental marketplace. So also note that testing it takes place at the pre-application stage. So we use testers who are actors, who are not actually applying for housing, but they are acting as if they are applying to get a sense for how folks might be experiencing that process. So in audit-based testing, we are looking at a range of different targets, depending on the protected classes we're testing. It may be about regions. In this case, this testing we did was focused on source of income, race and color, and national origin. So those audit tests, again, are somewhat randomized, but they're intended to give us a picture of what's happening in the marketplace. Complaint-based, and the benefit of that is when we develop that picture, it might help inform how we move policies and recommendations forward as a committee or as a jurisdiction related to what the findings are in the testing. Complaint-based testing, as the name suggests, is actually based on someone coming forward with a complaint around housing discrimination. So if we have somebody who calls us and says, I'm experiencing housing discrimination, one of our investigatory techniques might be to follow up with testing of whatever they've brought forward. It might be testing a property or a certain housing provider or a certain type of protected class or transaction. And as you can imagine, because that complaint-based testing is more of, you know, what we might term a hot lead, when we have complaint-based testing, it could potentially skew the data, right? We might have, for instance, higher level of positive tests or positive outcomes on a test when we are pursuing complaint-based testing versus when we have that more randomized sample in audit testing. So we want to make that distinction here. In this case, this year, and we're going to talk about why this occurred, we actually didn't pursue any complaint-based tests. So all the tests that we are going to talk about today are audit tests and can provide that data and snapshot around the experience of folks in the rental marketplace. As I said, this is a report that captures tests that were conducted between July 1st of 2020 and June 30th of 2021. So it aligns with the Housing Bureau's fiscal year. So we conducted in that time period a total of 44 paired audit tests. And so the methodology we use for testing is paired testing. And so what it is there is a protected class tester, or a protected characteristic tester, and a comparative tester, and who have similar traits, except for the difference is the protected characteristic. And so those two testers then go into the marketplace in the same fashion or the same to the same provider with the same set of questions, and then we compare how they're treated based on, and if there are differences, then again, in that methodology, the difference between those two folks seeking rental properties is the protected characteristic. So all of these, again, were conducted for the Housing Bureau. So they were conducted within the city of Portland's city limits. And as I said, this year and over the last couple of years, we have focused on race and color. And then which we list here the same for protected classes. They're separate protected classes. There can be some nuance in the way those can be distinguished, but for testing purposes, they are grouped together. And we also tested on national origin and predominantly using testers who had a discernible foreign accent so that they were identified as somebody who might not be, whose national origin may not be from this country. And then source of income, we also tested on again, and that was generally speaking, somebody who has was a Housing Choice Voucher holder. All right, I'm gonna move on from there. Let's see. So again, I covered some again of the purpose of this audit testing is really to inform our work around the analysis of impediments or assessment of fair housing to provide us a data point that talks about what discrimination or differential treatment might look like in the marketplace. So it's not intended to be a statistically valid point of evidence that says X number of housing providers in the city of Portland discriminate based on this protected class. The sample size just isn't big enough to do that. The purpose, again, is to give us that qualitative data about the experience that folks in this marketplace are having based on their protected characteristics. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the considerations that were specific to this year. As we've all been experiencing, one of those is the stay-at-home orders or the continuing pandemic. So that impacted, for instance, our ability to do in-person testing. When we test on race and color, our preference would be to do in-person testing so that somebody who would present as a person of color or of a different race would be seen by the housing provider. But we aren't able to do that during this testing. And so we actually used email testing, and there are some pieces of methodology that are nationally accepted around how we convey someone's race or color based on an email test. So I think Anirban may talk further about methodology, but again, it's this matched pair testing where we are using two different actors with very similar profiles, except for the difference in the protected class characteristics. So it might be, again, a person who has a discernible accent to convey a different national origin, a person who has characteristics that indicate that they might have be a different race or color, and then also similarly, somebody who explicitly says, I have a housing choice voucher, and to measure the differential or same treatment of those two folks. I'll talk a little bit about the evaluation process in the next slide when we talk about what is in the Fair Housing Act, the statute itself. That's what we actually use to evaluate tests based on differential treatment. So again, some limitations of testing or just the work that we do around fair housing in general, we purposely use the words or term differential treatment or different treatment versus discrimination. Discrimination is a legal term that is really intended to establish what somebody's intent was to discriminate. And in the testing that we do, we actually can't determine that. What we can determine is that somebody was treated differently. And in our methodology, the only difference between those two individuals was the protected class characteristic. And so the assumption would be that they were treated differently based on their protected class status. We also are in a housing market that is very tight and also has some particular peculiarities around COVID-19 protocols. So that can make testing and testing protocols a little more difficult. Again, for instance, we're going to talk about the low number of retests we did this year, and that was really related to vacancies that filled very quickly. There's my little dog, who was vacancies that filled very quickly for some housing providers that had smaller numbers of units. So again, that's a condition of the marketplace that is really, that drives some of the opportunities we have in testing. As I said, again, this isn't work that's statistically significant, but it is work that is important and vital for us to understand what folks might be experiencing in the marketplace. It's also important to understand, as I said, that this testing takes place at the pre-application phase. And so it tells us something about the very specific point in the housing spectrum. We also know, and we're going to talk a little bit about the statistics that we have around hotline calls, because that's an opportunity for folks who might be in-place residents to also contact us about when they might be experiencing discrimination. So it doesn't necessarily capture the experience of folks who are already in place and might be experiencing something different, but captures the experience of folks who are, and captures and intends to mimic the experience of folks who are seeking housing at that pre-application phase. So I talked again in the kind of earlier limitations about COVID-19 and the impact it's had on on, you know, all of us over the last year and a half and on our testing recently also. So as I said, you know, in talking about the evaluation process, you know, you can just take a quick look at this and folks don't have to memorize it. There's not going to be a test about the Fair Housing Act later and what's in the statute, but this actually outlines the different sections of the Fair Housing Act and the potential violations. So we use this list to establish when somebody has experienced differential treatment in a transaction, where that might fit in. So for instance, you know, discriminatory terms and conditions, right? So folks should be being offered the exact same terms and conditions when they are seeking places to live, regardless of whether or not they have protected class status. That's also true if you are a housing provider and you have multiple agents. Those agents should also be offering everyone the same terms and conditions. So that is not an alibi or excuse for folks to say, well, I don't know, maybe this agent offered something slightly different because it was a different person. Housing providers are held to a standard that says that all of their agents should be offering those same terms and conditions. So, oh, I'm sorry, that one, the top one there is discriminatory terms and conditions. So you can't have, you know, discriminatory terms and conditions, things like, you know, a blatant example would be no kids allowed, right? That's actually legal, but that would be a discriminatory terms and conditions. But discrimination in terms or conditions or services or facilities, because of disability is also a specific one. So the disability has its own protections. There are also, so one we see and we're gonna talk about when we talk about what occurred in the testing is this one around misrepresentation of availability of dwellings. So that might be another indicator that we've seen of folks who might be experiencing the marketplace differently, right? One person is told of, you know, two available units or a unit coming on next month, and the character tester isn't told about that extra availability or one might be coming along. I just want to give folks a sense for the kinds of pieces that are in the act that we use to evaluate the outcomes of the test and how we might pursue enforcement based in the different sections of the Fair Housing Act. I can, I don't know if I should pause here and answer questions, or maybe we should go all the way through, Brianna, and we'll take questions at the end. How about that? Let's do that. Because I'm going to pass next to my colleague, Anirban, who will talk specifically about the results of testing that we conducted this year.
Thanks, Alan. This table is actually the summary of all the tests that we did. The bottom right-hand corner is the total number of tests we did, 44 tests between June 2020 to July 2021. And you can see the distribution of tests, 15 tests were done for race, 14 tests for national origin, and 15 for source of income. Overall, about 50% of the tests came positive. And basically, we would like to reiterate this, and Alan alluded to this, that the percentage of positive tests relative to all tests, that shouldn't be read as a measure of housing discrimination in the city. And there are several reasons. One is the sample size. So our sample size, 14 or 15 under each protected class, makes it difficult to make any kind of inferential statistical or making any statistical inference out of these numbers. Even one or two positive tests would change those percentages in a big way. Also, second is that our sample of properties weren't completely random. Alan mentioned this, we target properties to test when we see something suspicious in the ad itself. So if we see a Craigslist ad which says, must have a professional job or something like that, that hints that they are trying to be selective about who they want to have as a tenant. And we would test those properties more than others. So, the likelihood of these percentage positive tests being high is possible because we are trying to target properties that that might be selective and who they rent out to. But we still see the value of doing this. The value of this document is that it creates a record of the barriers that limit diversity, integration, or equity in the city. So we ask you to read these numbers in that context and not as a measure of discrimination in the city. So the next slide, please. Okay, here we would like to note that there were 44 tests, out of which 42 were initial tests, and there were 2 retests. So retests are, they only occur when an initial test is deemed positive or inconclusive. So among the retests, one of the retests was on race, and the retest came out positive for different treatment, and another one was for source of income, and that retest was inconclusive. Also, this year's audit test data, if you look back at our report from last year, it shows an increase in the share of tests that came out positive relative to previous years. And that may have something to do with the addition of us doing a lot more email tests this year. We did some email tests last year, but this year we have we've learned lessons from those experiences and have used email tests quite extensively, not just in race, where we couldn't do any in-person tests, and we weren't able to do phone tests because it's not easy to convey the race of a tester or race of an applicant on the phone. So it's we have used email tests in the previous years to do race tests, but this year we have also used email tests for the other 2 protected classes under this grant. So it appeared from our searches of vacancies that there were more options to engage through email contact with smaller housing providers, which may have influenced the results differently this year versus previous years. Next slide. So let me go into details of each of those test results. So first, race and color, 15 tests. We saw 5 positive tests, so about 33% positive. These were done entirely by email. So test coordinators would create fake email addresses of 2 email addresses that we would use, where we would use names that are racially identifiable. So Census Bureau releases lists of first names and last names that are mostly African-American names that are not used by white Americans. So we created these email addresses based on some of those names that are in that list for the black tester. And the white tester, we used a name that is a common white name, John, David, that sort of name. Given the demographic mix here in Oregon, we didn't have to do anything in particular to highlight the white tester's race in this case. But for the black tester, we made sure we added in the signature of the email a quote from Malcolm X or one of the civil rights leaders, just to emphasize the point that somebody who's writing with that name might be an African-American. So next slide talks about this is the qualitative information that we gathered from our testers, the actual impediments that were identified. This is the different treatment under those categories that Alan showed from the statute. So in the case of race, we see misrepresentation of availability. For instance, there was a white tester who white tester was told of multiple specific properties in an area, whereas the black tester was told that they may have availability at a couple of sites, but asked them to check back on their website to find out more. There was stonewalling. There were three examples of tests where black tester never received a response, whereas the white tester did receive response. So one was when a white tester received a response asking if they were available to schedule a viewing with specific times of availability listed, and the black tester attempted to contact housing provider twice but did not receive a response. Another test where a white tester received a response from housing provider after 4 days, apologizing for the delay in response, and black tester never heard a response from the housing provider. Another example was tester sent an initial email without response. Both testers sent a second email inquiring about the property. White tester received a response requesting the tester's phone number to schedule a viewing, but the black tester never received a response. Then there was also a case where there was no possibility for follow-up contact, where a white tester was provided a contact phone number to speak directly with an on-site manager by email, whereas the black tester never heard back. So they didn't have that opportunity to contact back. Then there was evasive communication. In one test, both testers emailed within 1 hour apart. White tester received a response with option to come view the apartment and was asked personalized follow-up questions about the rental needs. The black tester was told due to inclement weather, there may be an option to view apartment virtually, but was never given the link or the way to do so. So those are some of the examples of the impediments that were faced by the black tester in this case, relative to what was offered to the white tester. Next slide, please. Yeah, so national origin tests, these were primarily done by phone, but a few of them were also done by email. And the names used here in the email tests were Latinx names, but we also added some Asian tester in this this year. So we have some Asian tests also this year, given the pandemic and some hate crimes against Asians in the city. So we wanted to be mindful of that. So there were 10 positive tests out of 14, pretty high number here. And then I'll talk about a little bit about the different treatment offered in the next slide. So here, there are basically two categories of different treatment we found. So misrepresentation of availability in all of the 5 instances of different treatment based on misrepresentation of availability that we reported here, tested with no foreign accent was told of either more specific information about units that were available, or were told of more number of units that were available, or were told of lower rent options compared to the compared to what was told to testers with an identifiable foreign accent. So for instance, a tester with no foreign accent was told of more specific details about available units, whereas tester with an identifiable accent was given less specific information and were merely told to check the website. A tester with no foreign accent was told an additional available unit, whereas tester with an identifiable accent was not told of the extra available unit. There are a few other examples. I'm not going to, they're more or less similar. But then in different terms and conditions part, we see, for instance, a tester with a foreign accent was told of new additions to the apartments. So whereas testers with an identifiable accent was not told of those apartment features or amenities. tester without a foreign accent was told that the agent could email an invitation to apply and video tour the apartment, whereas tester with an identifiable accent was not given this invitation. Tester without a foreign accent received a prompt response to voicemail inquiry about property, whereas tester with an identifiable accent left the same identical information in a voicemail inquiry, but did not receive a response from the agent. Tester without a foreign accent offered a tour of the unit and given information on how to schedule a tour, whereas tester with an identifiable accent was not offered tour information. More or less similar kinds of issues. Then tester without foreign accent told of a substantially less expensive monthly rent than the tester with an identifiable foreign accent, who was told of more expensive monthly rent for the same unit. Tester without a foreign accent told how to apply and was provided information about virtual tour options, whereas tester with an identifiable accent did not receive this information. And lastly, there was a test where the tester without a foreign accent was told about different amenities as well as information about virtual tour options, whereas tester with an identifiable foreign accent was not given this information. So those are the two broad categories of different treatment under national origin. I'll let LaDonna talk about the source of income tests.
Yes, hi. So unlike race and national origin, source of income is not federally protected, which Alan went over earlier. Before July 1st of 2014, property owners could legally refuse to rent to people receiving federal rent assistance. This included Section 8 vouchers through the state housing assistance program. So we went ahead and did 15 tests that were conducted. 6 were positive, 3 were inconclusive, and 6 were negative. Additionally, today, source of income is only protected at the state level. And while the percentage of single parent households, families with children, immigrants, people of color, and disabled individuals who receive vouchers in the city of Portland is massively beyond the scope of this report, it's entirely possible and likely that these federally protected classes may be disproportionately harmed by the disparate impact based on the source of income. So out of the 44 tests, 15 were focused on source of income. We found that 6 were positive and 3 were inconclusive, 6 were negative. We identified 2 main categories. We can go to the next slide. Sorry, Alan. We identified 2 main categories in which different treatment was positive based on source of income. The first one being refusal to rent, both overt and covert. In one case, both testers sent an identical email inquiry regarding a unit's availability and received the same response on that unit's availability from the housing provider. Both testers provided similar follow-up questions. Aside from the protected class tester inquiring about their Section 8 voucher, the tester without a Section 8 voucher was provided specific information about applying, rental criteria, and additional follow-up questions and emails to see if they were still interested. However, the protected class tester with the voucher, upon revealing their Section 8 voucher, they did not receive a response or any further communication from the agent. A common theme in the refusal to rent presents in the housing provider initially treating both testers fairly, but once that protected class tester with the voucher reveals their status as a rental assisted resident, the housing providers would cease communication, even when the protected class tester would send a follow-up email. They would still get that stonewall. Other forms of different treatment present in different terms, conditions, privileges, services, and/or facilities. It was identified that housing providers did not disclose to testers without a Section 8 voucher that renter's insurance was required, whereas the tester with a Section 8 voucher, upon disclosure, the housing provider stated uncertainty around whether or not they would accept that voucher, as well as telling the protected class tester that renter's insurance would be required. Additionally, testers with no Section 8 vouchers were asked for their contact information and would receive that follow-up communications about application fees, availability, and specific time frames for the provider's housing wait list, if they had one. While the tester with a Section 8 voucher was not asked for those their emails or given any follow-up communication regarding application fees and those additional questions. We can go to next slide. So our audit indicates there's a lot of work that remains to be done to ensure Portland receives equal treatment and having equal opportunity to access the housing of their choice. Critically, as Alan kind of touched on earlier, testing can only shed light on different treatment that occurs at the pre-application stage of this process. Our hotline data is anecdotal evidence that adverse treatment based on protected classes transpires in all phases of housing, including but not limited to screening of applications, treatment of in-place tenants, but it can also go into post-tenancy as well. Unfortunately, the audit that we've done does not allow for testing beyond the pre-application phase, but it does provide a summary of the protected classes of callers to our housing discrimination hotline. 15% of callers indicated race or color with the basis of their allegation, 4% indicated national origin, and 6% indicated source of income. This information does support the findings of our audit test discussed earlier. Crucially, many of the hotline callers report incidences of illegal discrimination that are in the post-application phase, or current in-place tenancy phase, and some in that post-tenancy as well. This complements our audit data that captures incidents of different treatment during the pre-application phase. However, both indicate the reality of different treatment in housing based on race, national origin, and source of income, continuing to be a concern in the city of Portland. I'll pass it back to you, Alan.
Thank you, Madonna, and thank you, Honorbon, for talking through those details of the testing. And I want to point out to folks a couple things. We realized in going through the report that there's a paragraph above this table in the final report that didn't have the percentages updated. So the percentages in this table are correct. The paragraph above that, we didn't update those from the previous year. So we'll do that and redistribute that to make sure it's accurate. I'm working on a presentation for as part of a panel for our National Fair Housing Alliance, and just looked at the statistics from the trends data at the national level. And they match very closely to what we see here in the state and in the city of Portland. So these track pretty well with what we see in other places in the country. Also want to point out for folks that if you had a chance to look through the report itself, the pieces that Honorbon and LaDonna went through about the impediments that were identified, there's actually longer details about the barriers there. And so if you want to look through theirs, it does, again, that's really the crux of this testing, is to really identify what that differential treatment looks like that might help inform how we get to better opening up access to housing. Also recognize for folks that it can sometimes be difficult for us to go through this data and to talk about the experience that some folks are having. So did want to just take a pause for a moment before we go on to recommendations to recognize that it can be difficult, knowing that there are folks who are not actors who are having this same experience in the housing marketplace. All right, so we'll give ourselves a breath. Okay, recommendations. So as you can imagine, not much has changed in what we've seen in the results of testing over the last few years, the last several years. In fact, as we said, in some cases, it has gotten a little bit worse for a couple of different factors. So many of the recommendations stay very much the same for what we look at coming out of this work based on the testing we did. One of them is the work that we do in collaboration with culturally specific organizations, particularly in Portland area with Urban League and El Programa Hispano Catolico. Again, this was identified a couple of years ago in one of our testing reports that even when we see, you know, I think when I look at this table and see the what I think is actually underreporting from race and color, my sense is that there is a different policy solution we might need. One of those that came forward was for us actually to form this collaboration with these culturally specific organizations to help them learn more about fair housing, to provide a trusted partner in a culturally specific organization paired with the client. So again, rather than just doing a sort of warmish handoff where, you know, they say, well, call the Fair Housing Council of Oregon and report what's happening to you, they are actually continuing to manage that client. They are managing them with a housing navigator. So in addition to you know, being able to help them navigate the complaint process, they're actually helping them find housing too, which is something we actually don't do as an organization. So it really has a lot of benefits for folks that are experiencing housing discrimination. It can also help that person go through that process, because it can't, it's not always easy, and it can help explain what's happening in the process, what may or may not happen in that process. Again, rather than having somebody just trust us, you know, some folks even see us sometimes as a quasi-government agency, so that trust level isn't the same as that you might experience from a culturally specific organization especially. This is actually a model that we continue to expand. Some of the work that we're gonna do around the state will continue to expand this model, where we partner with community groups to reach those communities that we think are underreporting and provide them with a trusted resource in addition to the legal expertise that we provide in fair housing. So that's one of the initial recommendations that have come out, is for us to continue that work. Again, in an ideal world, we could expand that out to all of the protected classes and all of the groups that might have trusted relationships in different ways. But for now, that's the work we're doing around race and color with culturally specific organizations that represent those groups. The other kind of top level recommendation is around the work that we do in education and outreach. There's still a need, of course, to continue to reach housing providers in different way. I think we can talk specifically about the outcomes here and some of the housing providers that were smaller housing providers, right? I think it does support this narrative that, not a narrative that housing, smaller housing providers discriminate more. I think what they are is less resourced, right? We know that smaller housing providers tend not to have access to the resources that can make sure they understand their responsibilities around fair housing. I'm not sure if there's a good solution to that, but we know that that can happen in the marketplace. Very large housing providers tend to understand what their liability is, tend to be able to offer resources to the folks that are providing services. And their hope is that that reduces some of the potential problems out there. But they are better resourced is what I would say. You know, I think reporting wise, it can be difficult for us to do direct consumer or direct resident training, because such a high proportion of what folks are experiencing is in the landlord-tenant space. You know, probably 90% of the calls we get are landlord-tenant issues. And so it really is more advantageous for us to work directly with social service providers, advocates, and that kind of train-the-trainer model, where we're making sure folks who are touching clients or reaching out to clients understand and can listen for fair housing violations as they're doing that work. Again, it can be sometimes more difficult for folks in the general public to truly understand, you know, the difference between a landlord-tenant issue and a fair housing issue. So that's one of the models that we also use. You know, testing is one of the measures that we use to monitor the housing market. It's the sort of traffic cop model, right, where some folks who are going to be inclined to follow the law, if they know that they are being monitored, if they know that there's a traffic cop behind that billboard, they might not speed. There certainly is a percentage of folks out there who, regardless of who's watching, are going to violate the law. And, you know, again, if we can get rid of all the other folks who will just follow the law, if we know we're watching, then we can kind of focus on the folks who are just going to blatantly or continue to operate outside the law. You know, we also need to make sure that we have partners that are effective. We know that the Bureau of Labor and Industries, which is the state civil rights overseer, is going to reestablish its substantial equivalency here in, I think, this month, actually. I think it's about to expire. They should also be renewing their contract with HUD, which will allow them to be better resourced to take on enforcing not only state protected classes, but all federal protected classes. They also are, we are working in partnership with BOLI and that work we're doing around the state regionally to expand access to housing discrimination resources and fair housing and legal support. So further recommendations kind of beyond that top level of the work we do really are come out specific about what we found this year. And again, this is a continuing issue around housing choice vouchers. Again, if you've heard me talk about it, one of the things I've said is, we are now whatever 5 or 6 years beyond having made a source of income a protected class. I'm not sure where that leaves us policy-wise, if we've had enough education and outreach or where we are. We continue to see problems. It's actually not particular to Portland. And so we got to figure out what the next step in that is. Again, we also know that not only is it related to Section 8 voucher holders, it also in this era now is also related to emergency rental assistance and those intersections. So it's a good time for us to talk about what that means and how we approach that particular issue. We also know that, especially around potentially race and color and national origin, that conversations about racial stereotypes and bias might play into how some folks might be experiencing the housing marketplace. The housing marketplace is no different than very many other aspects of what folks experience in the community. So the hope is that if we can bring some awareness, again, particularly for me, impactful is the history of fair housing and how we got to this moment in time can be impactful in helping folks understand the implicit and institutional pieces that might exist that keep people out of housing. We no longer test as much around disability because it's pretty clear when you see the statistics around Hotline. It's also very clear when somebody is discriminated against based on disability, right? They are denied the opportunity for reasonable accommodation. They're denied access to an emotional support animal. And so that really is an enforcement and education issue. We don't need to discover what that looks like. We know what it looks like. So we need to figure out what the resources are to take that on. So for instance, a nuanced piece in that is, housing providers tend to know about reasonable accommodations. They don't always know the details of how to go through it. But for instance, medical providers don't always know how they might best support folks who could benefit from a reasonable accommodation, right? They don't know, what can they say? What can't they say? What can they do? So that's another kind of issue where it's like, we resource some folks like that to better understand what their responsibilities are, right? So it's across, there's lots of different areas that we can talk about that that have an impact on the marketplace. In the testing itself, again, we have a fairly small number of tests that we focused in a certain way. We also know that other areas that we might approach in testing would be things like the disproportionate impact of criminal justice involvement in some communities, as well as credit score or the lack of credit in the marketplace. So again, those are areas that take a little bit more nuanced testing, but certainly are ones that might show that same disparate impact that we see on source of income. Those same kinds of categories, we would see the same kinds of intersections, I think. There are a few more pieces in the report. Again, these are all laid out in the report. These are all related to what we think housing providers might benefit from. Again, that first one there is really making sure that housing providers are reviewing the practices and policies that they have in place to make sure that none of them are discriminatory or offer differential treatment. We actually do come across that. And again, that's an easy fix for us. We can easily reach out to a housing provider and say, this is actually a violation of fair housing. We can't get to them all, but so when folks point it out to us, it's an easy one to kind of get to. Again, this piece about equivalent information, again, that's something that we do run into with housing providers, that differential treatment and information that's giving out. And also again, it's not an excuse that it was two different agents. So if that's a training issue for you, if your agents aren't all treating people the same or giving them the same information, that's still a violation of the Fair Housing Act, okay? This one around making sure they understand that the potential vacancies and provide all those options, it's hard to know why that occurs. We heard it pretty predominantly in differential treatment. And so it's hard not to think of it as just an error, right? It really does tend to seem like bias. because it seems to occur over and over in protections. So I'm not sure what the solution is there. It might be underlying bias or some kind of controls in how folks are offering information. I don't know, but it was a theme that was repeated in what we found. Again, you know, housing, you know, we have a fairly small space in the marketplace. Housing providers could certainly test themselves and secret shop themselves, right? Other corporate entities actually do that. Lots of them do it. You know, in retail spaces, they all have their own folks that are checking their customer service. And so I'm not sure housing providers are inclined to do that, but it's one way that they could potentially unearth how they might be interacting with folks who are seeking housing. And again, this one isn't about testing, but we know that, again, as our hotline data tells us, that folks of protected class status are having a different experience in their housing. And so they, housing providers, need to make sure that they are treating in-place residents in a way that is not discriminating. So with that, we are at the end of our report and happy to take on questions, clarifications. And so I'll just open that up. And Jay, I see your hand. I don't know if you want me to run the questions beyond. Is it? Yeah, Jay.
So I heard you just say, sorry, let me gather myself. I'm going to be honest, and this whole data is very activating for me. I'm not surprised by anything that we found, and it feels like a lot of the same over and over all the time. And so I have two questions. The first question is, why is it kind of just like, I don't know how you framed it, Alan, but just that it's a given that we know that folks with disabilities are being discriminated against or whatever word we're using. So it's not something that we have to really test, but something that we have to address. What is the difference between other folks from protected classes why is it that we know folks with disabilities, but we can't just take it as a no that folks from racial background, ethnic backgrounds, people with accents, why isn't that just a no? Why are we even testing this?
Yeah, Jay, I think that's a great question. The way I would frame it is it's more obvious in the way the statutes work when there's a violation, is what I would say. I think there's no question that folks of protected class status by race and color, national origin, are having a different experience in the marketplace. What we don't know is what it looks like and how to prove it in context of the Fair Housing Act. And that's a real difficult piece in civil rights work, is actually the evidence that tells us how we could move forward in an investigation. Again, in a case with disability, it's pretty clear that the person has been told, no, you cannot have a emotional support animal. That's a clear violation. Or no, we're not gonna give you a parking spot. You know, we don't see that today as often, where somebody says, I'm not gonna rent to you because I think you're undocumented. We certainly have heard that, but it's not as common as, no, I'm not going to allow your emotional support animal. Does that help?
Yeah, kind of. The second test, I see other hands raised. The second question that I had is, what is the consequence? What consequence do people face when we do these findings? Like, for instance, the folks who you found, what is it, just a phone call like, hey, you did this wrong, and then that's it? What would incentivize folks to say, I need to do my own testing because I don't want to be fined, or I don't want, what consequences are there?
Yeah, you know, thanks. Yeah. Was there more? I'm sorry.
That's it.
Okay. You know, in the case here, as we said, these were predominantly audit tests, and there were just a couple of retests. For us to move forward with enforcement actions, we would need to be able to complete at least one other retest, and very often at least three in a series, to confirm what has occurred there. Again, it's a legal evidence gathering piece. And very often we don't have that opportunity. One of the things we saw this year, as I said, as Anirban talked about, we had the opportunity to use those email tests. And very often smaller housing providers will only provide email contact rather than phone contact. So we were able to use the email to test those folks, but their vacancies also went away quicker. And so we weren't able to continue to test them. Whereas folks who have more vacancies, we can continue to test them even on other properties. So in this particular testing, you know, we weren't able to pursue enforcement actions in any of these. Certainly in other venues we have, and it takes that legal investigation to get to a point where we can file a complaint or begin a legal enforcement action. And that's really what it does take. We really do need to be able to get to that level of effort in the marketplace to hold folks accountable. I think that you know one of the ways we could ask folks to self-test is to make it part of a settlement with them. To say part of what you're going to do based on your violation was to do X number of self-tests, right? That can be a part of the remedies. But yeah, in this testing itself, given the low number of tests and the way that they transpired with vacancies, we're not able to proceed that way with any of these tests.
Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know who was next between Mara and Marisa.
I think Mara was next.
Go ahead, Mara.
I'll be really quick. I was just going to say, I don't know if there's any space for it in testing, mm-hmm. but also thinking about intersectionality. I know that's what we've been focused on at ILR doing our housing advocacy, is that when we've reached out to the disabled communities of color, we find that they're even less informed about their rights as disabled individuals. So especially around the source of income thing, that's just because it's state specific. It's not as much in the atmosphere for people to pick up online or through their friends and family. And I think that's been one of the big things around disability, is like we've gotten a lot of attention. And you're right, Alan, the process of proving discriminatory treatment. It's like there's proof in paperwork around like the reasonable accommodation process, the licensure of your provider. Obviously, we don't have those same kinds of protections. So when I sometimes work with disabled person of color, it's the disability part that we focus on, because it just feels a little bit more provable. Like, racism is so systemic and part of the culture. That's at least what I'm hoping for Housing Council will kind of do too, is to think about, like you mentioned, how interwoven that is to everything. And disability culture is very white, and that's what we're working on as it relates to that. That probably has something to do with the fact that, that's why that disability number is so big too. So anyway, just putting that out there, intersectionality may be an important thing to consider. And I don't know if that's part of your testing.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Mara. What I will say is two things. One, it's definitely part of the work we do around education and outreach and public policy. We tend not to do it, just like you said, in testing as much, because we are trying to isolate actually the protected characteristic in the testing to make sure that we can clearly elucidate what the issue was that created differential treatment, right? If we actually had that intersection that we were testing on, we might not be able to use that legally to say it was based on disability or was based on race. We are actually isolating those very often in testing. There's another set of methodology that's related to, for instance, kind of testing multiple identities in protected class, but it's a different methodology that actually takes more resources and multiple tests to go through that.
Well, I appreciate it, because as an advocate, obviously, I have anecdotal evidence up the wazoozle, but it's, the reality comes down to numbers. And, I often shorthand it to rights versus reality. And a lot of times people need to know what their rights are in order to deal with the reality of what they face out there.
Thanks. I don't know if my colleagues had anything to add to any of the last couple of questions, Anirban or LaDonna or KT, anything that I might have missed or didn't bring forward before I go to Marisa.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is we did test the same property multiple times on multiple protected class when we saw they are trying to discriminate on one basis, but we haven't tested intersectionality where we had, a Black woman with a Section 8 voucher seeking housing compared to white male or even a white non-housing subsidy, non-housing voucher tester. So that kind of creates complications in how to use that test as an evidence in any case. So we haven't done testing on intersectionality, but we do try to test if there is a positive test in one protected class, we would then try to retest. It wouldn't be counted as a retest because we are not doing a test on the same protected class, but we would test the property on another protected class.
Thank you, Anirban. Ryan, do we want to pause? And Brian, do you want to pause for, it's 4:15 now for public, check in on public comment?
Yes, now we are entering our scheduled public comment period. At the beginning of the meeting, I don't believe we had anyone signed up, but if there's anyone who wants to provide public comment or public testimony, now is the time and you can raise your hands. How long do we usually hold it open, Ryan?
Not terribly long, just long enough to give everyone a chance if there's anyone who wants to speak.
Okay. Sit in silence for another minute to see. Okay, I think we can roll onwards. And I think Marisa was about to ask a question.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Brian. So first off, thank you so much to the folks here from Fair Housing Council of Oregon for the presentation. There's so much in there. Actually, I want to apologize that my voice is kind of hoarse today. So I hope you don't have trouble understanding me. But I just wanted to say there's so much in there to take away from this. Especially like some of the things you noted around, you know, using more emails than phone calls and like where it may be actually not possible to, you know, conduct these inquiries by phones, you're having to rely on email. I found that really interesting, just coming from the service provider background and where you would have, you know, a normal procedure change, you know, over time. So that actually kind of fits, I would say like kind of trends even before the pandemic and just finding that, you know, phone calls are sometimes a dead end or it can depend on like the property management company, et cetera. But I just found that really interesting. I had a couple of questions though. Stood out to me the most was around source of income discrimination. And so two things. One, I would say, you know, I'm just curious when you talk about emergency rental assistance and like how that could be maybe a potential avenue to explore in the future. I imagine that would bring a lot more complexity into the picture for testing, you know, because it's a tenant in place. And I guess I'm just, I don't know, is there like anything more you could share about that and like how, where there might be opportunities to, well, this kind of folds into my other question is like for this committee to advocate for expanded testing along those lines, just because it feels like right now, obviously we are in this place where, you know, you do see many potential hurdles for folks who are seeking rent assistance. And, you know, just if nothing else, the fact that there's probably more data right now out there for people to kind of draw from as far as experiences go. So I just wondered if you'd talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks, Marisa. Yeah, I haven't thought much about the testing and emergency rental assistance. I think it's going to some degree, present itself without testing, right? It's kind of that same thing where we may not need to test it, And I'm not sure how it's going to manifest itself yet. We've seen some of it where, for whatever reason, housing providers are not accepting emergency rental assistance. I'm just not sure, why you wouldn't exactly. But there's reasons. And again, we think that can be problematic based on source of income. It depends on the circumstances. You potentially, and I guess our testing coordinators may have to talk or think about it if they want to chime in a little. We could potentially test on somebody who was applying to say that, they are coming with, they're in a situation where they're going to be using or accessing emergency rental assistance when they rent. And is that okay? In the same sense that, somebody might say, I have a housing choice voucher, or I'm working with, Northwest Pilot Project to access emergency rental assistance. Is that going to be okay? That might be how you see it. But again, just conveying to a housing provider that you're going to be accessing that alternate source of income might be the way that we look at measuring what that experience might be for folks that are in that situation. I don't know that we'll move that quickly given how things are going to transpire here and how the money's going out the door. My sense is we'd be more likely to see it on the reporting side, the enforcement side, where folks are just saying, I've got this emergency rental assistance and, my housing provider won't accept it.
Thank you. I guess my other question, similar lines, is the fact that when it comes to Section 8, I think a lot of folks here are aware that, regionally we are going to have a little bit of an influx of flexible vouchers that are modeled after Section 8 that will be used through the Supportive Housing Services measure, which is super exciting. It makes me very, very happy to say that. But at the same time, of course, you have these concerns about where folks may have limited opportunities to use them, et cetera. And so again, this is maybe more of a question to the committee around, can we in some way advocate for some better look at what these experiences are like? Like, what is showing up the way you phrased it, Ellen, with, different treatment? Is it happening, and what does it look like to any degree for folks who may start utilizing those vouchers? You talked a little bit about complaint-based testing. So is there that opportunity to at least have there be kind of a pool of funds or something like that to do some complaint-based testing as that comes up?
Yeah, actually we are. In the work that we do in the contract that we have with the Housing Bureau now, we are open to doing complaint-based testing. So we're, it's not something we control though. And that's the difficulty is, we're balancing wanting to make sure that we are able to complete all the tests at the same time, making sure we leave open the opportunity if a complaint comes up. And so those two things are a balance, but it's also difficult for us to talk about our work that way, but we're ready and waiting for complaints that come forward that we can test in the work that we do. And I think, Melissa, what you're talking about with permanent supportive housing, the thing I will go back to saying is, I agree, as a committee, it might be something that we talk about with regard to rent, different types of assistance that's going out in those areas and providers that might be part of those systems and what we could do to encourage them to not only around vouchers and assistance, but things like low barrier screening, right? To make sure that the work that's being done is maximizing the opportunities for folks that might not have them otherwise, to make sure that our, the providers were leveraging aren't making that problem worse, essentially. I think it was Taylor and then Mara.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of thoughts on the conversation about voucher utilization and in addition to testing, maybe some possible policy strategies to consider advocating for as a group as well. So one of the reasons that housing authorities terminate vouchers is if it expires, which means that the household is unable to find an apartment where they can use their voucher, which is, of course, the amount of time that takes is very much informed by racial bias or other forms of bias that folks are experiencing in the housing market. So in looking at some data around rates of termination, we did find that there is a disproportionate representation for Black voucher holders who are terminated because their voucher has been expired. So that's something that we, as the Housing Authority for Multnomah County, are looking into to reduce and address. That said, I think external resources to help provide housing navigation supports and sort of barrier busting for voucher holders to be resources who understand for housing law well and can support voucher holders and leasing up with their vouchers is something that we have done pilots for in the past that have been really successful and have increased voucher utilization, which is basically the number of vouchers that folks can successfully lease up with. So I just wanted to add, in terms of policy supports, advocating for possible housing navigation, and then of course enforcement for folks.
Thanks, Taylor. Yeah, I mean, there's sort of no shortage of evidence that there are folks in our who are having a different experience in the marketplace, without question. Mara, did you have another question you were going to bring forward?
Not a question. I was just going to say, I've noticed a lot of the newer housing providers that are flowing into the area to take advantage of the Metro Housing Bond and stuff are not as knowledgeable on maybe their rights and responsibilities, especially for those state specific things. So I don't know if there's any way to maybe partner, or we can as a committee, to with like the housing, you know, the larger kind of Oregon Housing Commission, and see if there might be something we could do to be notified of when a new housing provider comes into the area and isn't really aware, or should they be going to a Fair Housing Council training? You know, what are those requirements there? Because I think we do put it a lot on the individual to even educate their housing provider. So.
Thanks. Jay, did your hand pop up?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm taking up all the space. It is not an unusual, and I'm sure everyone on this call knows this, to have a conversation with a friend, whether it's a black man or someone with an accent, if it's your friend that is looking for housing, and they tell you all the mess that they're going through, and you kind of just look at each other like, yeah. So I'm wondering how this group can get away from this. This is just how it is. I just have to keep going until somebody doesn't discriminate against me, because I actually have a friend looking for a house right now, and he's got money in the bank, he's got a little girl, he's got a job, and he has had so much trouble. It just can't be, you know, it's not by chance that he's having this trouble. This is what happens. So how do it, or can this group even address the apathy that we feel? It's just like, I'm not going to call and report because nothing happens. What does enforcement look like? What are people even worried about consequences anymore? Like I understand the education, but you can train somebody all day long. If they're not going to do it, they're not going to do it. So are there incentive-based programs that can be created where you're actively not doing this, or you're something you can be, I don't know, given an award or something, but also what are fines looking like? If this is always around race, there is all the ambiguity where we can't prove this thing. We have all this evidence, but most of it's anecdotal. And then we have to keep, you know, testing and testing and testing until it's gone and everybody forgets about it. The person who's most impacted, nothing happens for them. It becomes a shrug, like, well, you know how it is. So I guess what I'm asking for is, what can this group do to address the people who have continuously been impacted by this larger system that exists everywhere in the United States? And that is really like, this is just the way of my life for the rest of my life. How can we address and build confidence that we are actually doing something and not just sitting around talking about it, and talking while we talk, they're still going through the same thing every single day? Or is that what we're doing here?
And that might be a good transition kind of back into the broader meeting event. If that makes sense, Brianna.
This is Mara. I'll just speak up and say I appreciate those thoughts. I would say there's a lot of that feeling around the housing in general, because the housing market is so horrible here. And I would say it's very hard to, at least as I have understood it, I've worked in Oakland, California as a housing advocate, and I've been in Baltimore and lots of other places. And what I continue to see is it's really hard to focus on the fair housing and make it a priority when the landlords have all the power and control around how things are working right now. And when you have a tight housing market, it's just, it's impossible to pull it apart sometimes between what is actually disparate impact or discrimination versus just a really, really hard housing market. I would say, obviously, it's both, but as it relates to trying to prove it and use committees and councils like this, it's like, again, I mostly do this, get engaged in this way to spend the time learning and understanding the recommendations we make. I guess I understand that. I mean, I don't know how other people feel, but at the end of the day, they really are just a recommendation. And I don't even know if they're going to listen to us. Alan, I know you have a lot of respect in the community. But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is, yes, I feel you every day. I feel that. And I want to give up on housing. But then the next day I get up and I'm like, okay, let's keep doing this. It's not fair. It's not right. And people, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that's helpful at all, but it's not okay. We shouldn't be sleepy. We should be fired up. We should be angry, and we should be talking about it on this call. Absolutely.
Marisa?
Yeah, I just kind of wanted to chime in. Yeah, I really appreciate your comments, Jay and Mara. I think getting maybe touching a little bit on what Taylor was saying earlier about policy recommendations, I guess I don't feel like I can speak to the full question of like this committee's immediate impact on experiences like the experience your friend is going through, Jay. But I definitely like putting it through that frame of urgency and like the individual experience, I think is so critical to this work, because I think one of the things that, you know, I know Taylor was touching on was, you know, that one-on-one advocacy and assistance and how far that can go in, not only maybe promoting a good outcome, but also identifying where there are folks who are, I guess you could say, bad actors, you know, people who without, I mean, despite any assertion to what the law is or what the rules are, they will continue to discriminate versus people who just don't know better. And, you know, so I say this a lot, you know, I spent 5.5 years as a case manager, and obviously I'm not a lawyer. I had to learn a lot about fair housing law on the job. But what I found was that when a person, I mean, it could even be a friend or neighbor, family member, kind of comes into the picture where an individual is dealing with a landlord, it kind of does seem to add something. And I just think that that's a powerful low-hanging fruit when it comes to maybe, you know, building out better programs and building out more access to fair housing. It's just the reality is when you have one person dealing with a landlord versus more eyes on the situation, and someone saying, hey, did you know that, you know, in Oregon, you can't require someone whose income is under 30% MFI to have rental insurance, like things like that. It's not necessarily that the person says, oh my God, you're a case manager, you know, I shouldn't do anything wrong. It's more just like, okay, I'm getting information here and I have to look at this again, you know? So I guess I just wanted to maybe add another plug for where assistance with folks and making that more accessible to folks who aren't necessarily, you know, engage with a community-based organization, et cetera, could go a really long way for both the folks seeking housing, but also in establishing maybe more awareness among landlords in a kind of a relationship-based way. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you all. You know, part of the role of FAC is to create recommendations. So, you know, you can review these recommendations that Fair Housing Council of Oregon has put together. You can think about additional recommendations that you want to make as a body. As we've talked about before, we will be undertaking a process in the coming months of doing a fair housing assessment, which could include analysis of impediments and additional recommendations on how to address these disparate impacts and sort of start pulling some of these issues apart. As I said before, we don't have a really firm update on that project and that work plan as of yet, and we will be doing that at the January meeting. Taylor?
In advance of that January meeting, is that something that we should come prepared? Like, should we all kind of come prepared with the recommendations that we would like to discuss as a group? Is there preparation that you would recommend in advance of the January meeting to kind of help guide that conversation? If the goal at the end is to have a set of recommendations that this body is agreeing on, I would love to discuss kind of how that goes and like what our decision-making structure is going to look like.
In response to the Fair Housing Council of Oregon's report?
Sorry, I think I heard you to say that this body can also discuss, so supporting those recommendations and possibly adding our own if there are additional recommendations that this body wants to make. And so just curious if I heard you correctly, and if that's the case, should we kind of come prepared with recommendations that we want to make to propose to the group to see if we can get support for certain things and what our decision-making process would look like?
I would think so. And I know my understanding is that Nikki is going to be working with Jay and Marisa in between this meeting and the meeting in January to sort of build out that agenda. So I think that part of that conversation is going to be housed within executive committee conversations on that. So I think there we will get back to you. Alan, sorry, I forgot for a second that I'm the one responsible for calling on people now.
No worries. The other thing I'd say, again, is, you know, the recommendations that we made in this report are tied directly to the findings of the testing. And again, as I pointed out, there are limitations to that. And so certainly I would encourage us as a group to think beyond those recommendations. And as we talk about that, one of the things I'd also say, Jay, in response to what you're saying is, that as a group, we should be intentional and really recognize, again, as I've said a couple of times here, I don't think we need too much more evidence to tell us that there are community members that are having a different experience in our marketplace. And we ought to be intentional about how we're approaching that problem. And that it is very much centered around race in this community. And we have to be a little careful about that from a fair housing perspective, but we also know that that is where there are some significant impacts being felt in communities.
Mara?
I apologize if I missed something when we first started too, but I think partly what threw me off when we first started is there was like those 2011 recommendations and we were kind of looking at those and some of it had been accomplished, some of it hadn't. And then we were maybe going to get new directives with the Biden administration. And it sounds like we're kind of still in that place, but I guess we were always okay just talking about whatever we wanted. And maybe with our chairs now, we're going to have more structure around what that might look like. Am I understanding that all correctly?
Yes. And we are going to be, the 2011 recommendations are related to the analysis of impediment and the analysis of fair housing that was conducted at that time. The Biden administration has indicated that they are going to require those again, I think around 2024, 2025. But we've decided that we are going to undertake a process of doing an analysis of fair housing over the next period of months, of which this body will be a holder of sort of that conversation. And that, when I'm talking about a work plan, that's sort of like the work plan that we are developing around that. And then there will be recommendations coming out of that work plan. So there's really going to be a lot of conversations and, you know, intentionality in how to address these sort of disparate impacts and different experiences that members of our community are facing.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. I apologize.
If anyone has any last thoughts.
I think it's to the group because I we're going to be making recommendations and I've never worked a job that didn't get stuck in the recommendation analysis survey. There's very little action when it comes to addressing the needs of people of color and people who live along the margins. And if we, I like Alan, when we talk about being intentional, I feel like we should really be intentional with the way that we write this up and deliver it for people. Like, you know, we are just, we, this group, if we're, all we're doing is giving recommendations that can't be enforced, then we need to be very strategic or creative around how we give these recommendations, and kind of like laying the groundwork for them to, when they start getting into this, well, let's take the survey again and let's talk to these people again, because that's where this work stays. That's why we're still here since 1968, right? So just for everyone, when we're thinking about how to step out of the box and not just write up a something that we're writing up, just how are we going to deliver our comments to folks to give people more than just a recommendation, to give them something to think about when they're figuring out how they're going to survey and analysis the people to death. So that's all I got. Sorry.
No, don't apologize, Jay. That's very wise words. Well, I think that concludes our agenda for today. Nikki and Marisa and Jay, I know Nikki is going to be in touch about scheduling an executive committee meeting with y'all. I don't know where she is in that process, but stay tuned. For everyone else, thank you for joining us and, you know, this very enriching conversation. Okay, see everyone in January.